Welcome to our midweek study. If you're visiting with us, we're glad to have you here. I invite you to come back when you have the opportunity. We'll be in Luke 17 tonight in a few minutes. We'll do a little review first and then get to our text for tonight. We are in the Life of Christ study, and we're down in the last section of his life right before the last week in the crucifixion. In fact, next class will be the last class in the close of the ministry. So we're like two classes away from starting that last week. So it's kind of give the time frame of where we are. So down to within a matter of weeks before Jesus makes it. In fact, we'll see tonight where he starts that final trip into Jerusalem, to Judea for that. And remember, Jews already wanted to kill him, and that just is cranking up higher and higher and higher now as we get to that peak headed toward that last time when he, under his control as to when it's going to happen, but when he comes to Jerusalem for that crucifixion. Just a map, did you mind, because you're kind of where we are. We'll look at again in a minute, the map. All right, last time we talked about three or four stories that happened just after Jesus left the temple area and the Feast of Dedication. We went back over to Perea, and several things we talked about there. The rich man and Lazarus, most of you are familiar with the story, but of course the rich man had everything, all he wanted, eat-wise, clothes-wise, dressed, fine clothing. And Lazarus was late at his gate every day. Apparently couldn't get there on his own, full of sores, just wanting some crumbs to eat. And of course they both died, and rich man is in torment, Lazarus is in Abraham's bosom and wants him to come across, give him just a drip of water on his finger to coat his tongue. And of course that could not be done because of each was reaping what he has sown in his lifetime. And then we look to the section where it talks about we read in the section that talks about watch out when you cause your brother to stumble, or when you cause another person to sin, the warning that's given for us there. And I looked at a number of translations. I'm having major trouble tonight. There it is. A number of different translations. It talks about this cause a brother to sin. And here's some of the other things that's used. It's impossible that no offenses should come. In other words, things are going to come our way. They're going to happen. It's impossible to exclude snares, one says. It's inevitable that there will be snares. Temptations to sin are sure to come. Things that cause people to sin will happen. Okay, so those things are going to happen. But what's the warning? You know, the warning is, woe to him who causes that to happen to someone else. So you cause, by your attitude, by your influence, by your speech, by what you say, you cause someone else to sin. You put a stumbling block, you put a snare before them. What I say is just, woe to you who would do such as that. But then the next part of that is, if your brother sins against you, you go to him and rebuke him. And if he repents, you forgive him, and there's no end to it. He repents, you forgive him. Many times it takes. There's no stopping that. We got the part about the unprofitable servant. The first disciples said, Lord, increase our faith. Then he told them about a man who'd been out, had a servant in a field working all day. And time for the servant to come into the house and it's time to eat. How many of you would have supper ready for that servant when he came in? No, you're not going to do that. Not if you're a master-slave situation. You go expect him to come in and feed you. And then, when you got through eating, then if he wants to eat, he prepares something for him. And the whole point is there, he says, say, when you have done all you can do, that you're still just doing your duty. Say when you've done all that you can do, we've done our everything that's our duty to do, that we've just done that. There's no praise, there's no extra for that. That's not saying, as I said Sunday, that's not saying we're unprofitable. That's saying our attitude is that we're only doing our duty when we've done all we can do. Let me move now to the area around, down toward Jerusalem. Jesus is fixed to come to Bethany to raise Lazarus. And we talked about the fact that Jerusalem sits here. We're looking to the from the southwest toward the northeast up this way. The temple area, the Kidron Valley down through here. And then over the top of Mount of Olives, and Bethany sits over behind the top of the mountain over there. So Jesus goes to the home of Mary and Martha, where Lazarus has just died and been dead for 4 days now. And of course, Mary and Martha said, if you'd been here, our brothers would not have died. And Jesus goes on then and tells them to remove the stone. He calls forth to Lazarus, and he comes out wrapped in the grave clothes and the effect it had on Jewish leaders of raising a man from the dead, had been dead for 4 days. Some of the Jews believed because of this. Others, instead of believing, went and told the Pharisees so they would know what was going on. And of course, they could get that much more ready to kill Jesus. In fact, that's exactly what happens. Caiaphas, his high priest that year, said, it is expedient for us that one man die, then the whole nation perish. Now, he's not talking about Jesus dying a spiritual death for the nation. He's talking about it's better off for us as a physical nation. It's better off for us in our political situation, our relationship with Rome, and whatever. If one man would die and we put this thing down, then have this thing stirred up, and the whole nation should perish. But then he goes on to prophesy in the next verse there, and he says that Jesus would die for the nation, not for this nation only, but he may gather others under his wing for that. So now they're trying to kill Jesus. Now, that was all a little bit. Now, moving into chapter 17. We're at chapter 17 and verse 11. We pick up tonight with our new stuff. So Luke 17, verse 11. All right. Jesus is going to leave Galilee and head towards Samaria. So he's up, we think he's up maybe along the border up here somewhere between Galilee and Samaria, this area up here. He's eventually going to come down this side over here and back across to Jerusalem, the final trip to Jerusalem. But right now, he's up here. He's headed toward Jerusalem. Of course, he won't come down straight down there, but that's his destination is Jerusalem. He's somewhere now probably up in the area around the border up there between Galilee and Samaria. And he's met by 10 lepers. And they cry out to him, Jesus, Master, have mercy upon us. And of course, they want to be healed of their leprosy. They evidently know who he is because they cry out to him. And he just tells them to go show themselves to the priest. Now, that was what was required in the law of Moses. If you had leprosy and you had gotten over it, you'd been cleansed of it, you had been healed of it, whatever, just go show yourself to the priest. That goes back to Leviticus, particularly chapter 14, the first three verses there. So that's what Jesus is telling them to do, just go show yourself to the priest. Did they realize as they were going to Jerusalem to the priest that they were cleansed? And one turned back to go tell Jesus thank you, to show their gratitude to him. So when he got back, Jesus said, where are the other nine? Why did this one come back? Particularly when he was a foreigner. He was a Samaritan. He was not a Jew. But he came back to give gratitude to God. And Jesus told him, said, your faith has made you well. I've looked at this in just one more minute here. So the question is, where's the gratitude? And we'll talk about that some more time. I have a little time left here. I want to just look at this theme, faith and obedience, a minute. If you got your Bible open there to chapter 17, look at verse 13. Verse 13 is where these 10 lepers cry out to Jesus. It says, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. What are they wanting? They're wanting to be healed, right? They're demonstrating a faith in Jesus that he can heal them. So they cry out to him and want to be healed. Now, he says down at the end of verse 19, your faith has made you well. But look what happens in between there. What happens in verse 14? Go show yourself to the priest. And as they went, okay, as they went, they realized they were cleansed. Faith? Yep, we have faith. But what did it take to go with it? Where were they cleansed? As they went, as they were obeying what Jesus said, do faith plus obedience. Now, summed up at the end, it says your faith has made you well, because faith was started. But faith plus obedience is very much demonstrated here with this. So then in verse 20, it gets into the question about the kingdom. So when is the kingdom coming, basically? And he said, it's going to come. It's going to come in the way you expect. You're not going to be able to say, oh, here it is, or there it is, or the kingdom's coming, or got the king here. It's not what you're envisioning the kingdom's going to be. That's not the kind of kingdom I'm going to have. It's not going to be that. Rather, he says, the kingdom's going to be within you. It's going to be a kingdom of believers. It's not going to be the kind of kingdom you're thinking of and looking for. That's not what it's going to be like. There'll be visible characteristics of the kingdom, but it's not going to be the visible characteristics you would see of an earthly kingdom as you have in mind. Okay. Verse 24. If you've got little dividers, subheadings in your the people who published the Bible you've got there, the translation you've got, you may have little subheadings in there that divide the chapters up and various things. A lot of them do. And yours may say there, like mine does, Jesus Christ teaches on the second coming. If you flip over to Matthew chapter 24, you're going to see a very similar type thing. Matthew 24, again, if you've got some subheadings there, like between verses 3 and 4, this one's got the tribulation in there. And down about verse 26, 27, the second coming. I don't think this part in Luke 17 is talking about the second coming. I don't think Matthew 24 is talking about the second coming. Now, 25 is, and we'll get to that later on and talk about it some. But I don't think really this is talking about the second coming when it comes to this. The destruction of Jerusalem and what's coming with it, and being on watch for the destruction that's coming to them. So Jesus tells them that they're going to suffer, and he's going to suffer and be rejected. So he's going to be gone. And they're not expecting that. We'll get that again in a few minutes. He'll get down and just tell them specifically what's going on. But he's going to be rejected. It's not going to be an earthly kingdom like they're looking for. No, they've quite got that in their heads yet. They're still trying to comprehend that. They've been looking for that all along. That's what the people thought the Messiah was going to do when he came, was to set up the earthly kingdom, the throne of David, and give them relief from Rome. Not going to happen that way. Okay? So he compares what's coming up. Again, I think we're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem here, to the days of Noah. But Noah's building the ark. What are people doing the whole time Noah's building the ark? Well, they're eating and drinking and carrying on and doing their normal type sinful self. Until all of a sudden, after Noah's been preaching to them for 120 years or something, that a flood's coming, guess what? It starts raining, and now what do they want to do? All of a sudden, they realize something's going on. So, but the earth's destroyed. But compared to the day of Lot, when the city of Sodom is just full of all kind of wickedness and things that's going on, and all of a sudden the messengers come in and pull Lot out, and what happens? Boom. God destroys the city. So it's going to happen suddenly. It's going to happen quickly, not when you're expecting anything. So destruction is going to come. And when it does, don't go back to get your possessions. Don't linger around. When you see the destruction coming, when you see the Roman army coming in to destroy Jerusalem, I think, get out. Run to the fields. Get out of town. Get out of the city, because they're going to destroy it. And Jerusalem was destroyed, of course, in AD 70 by the Roman army, about 40 years from now. It's not that long until it's going to happen. Okay. Moving to chapter 18, Jesus taught something about this judge. Call it the unrighteous judge. It's this judge who has no regard for God or man. He is... apparently, his own thing. He is the judge, and he doesn't care what anybody says or thinks or what God says or thinks, apparently. But the widow comes to him seeking relief from an avenger, seeking justice from this judge. And she keeps coming, and she keeps coming, and she keeps coming. And he couldn't care what happened to her. I mean, that's of no concern to him, really. But because of her persistence, because she keeps coming to him over and over, he grants her what she wants. He grants her relief from her adversary. He wasn't caring about giving her justice, another thing. He wanted his inconvenience stopped. He wanted her to quit being an inconvenience to him. Now, the contrast is there. With us and God. God loves us. Totally unlike the judge. God loves us. He cares for us. The judge had no care for her or what happened to her. She was a nuisance. I'll give her what she wants to get out of my way. If he would do that, what is a God who cares for us, who made us in his own image, who sent his son to die for us? What's he going to do for us? What's he going to be willing to do for us when we go to him and ask it? We go with persistence. We go with persistence. He's going to grant us what's best for us. I read across this. It's a little comparison. It compares the widow and the judge to us. The widow's a stranger and no relationship to this judge whatsoever. God's praying people are his own elect, who he knows, who he loves, and who he delights in. What's the difference? The judge wanted her to keep her distance. God said to us what? Come boldly before my throne. She came to an unjust judge. We come to a righteous father. She had no friend to speak for her, no one to add to her petition. What do we have? An advocate with the Father, his own son, who's here making intercession for us. She had no encouragement that he was going to give her what she asked for. None whatsoever. She just kept coming. We're told to ask, and we're promised that God would give us what's best for us. And she could only go to that judge when that judge is willing to see her. When can we go to God? When can we have access to our judge? Whenever we want to, all the time, day and night. So, quite a contrast between the two. Jesus follows this in verse 9 with a parable about two men praying. One's a Pharisee, one's a publican. Of course, a publican's a tax collector. What's the phrase you usually see? Tax collectors and sinners, right? Grouped right there together. So one's a Pharisee, one's a publican. Pharisee, righteous man, righteous in his own eyes. Keep in mind who the Pharisees are. Now, look at this prayer. Don't you notice something? Pharisee stood and prayed thus. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess. Did he say anything in way of praise or adoration to God? Did he go asking God for anything? What did he do? He told God how good he was, right? That's all he did. I think I'm not like this and this, this and this and this. Oh, here's what I do. I'm good. What a publican do? Humility. Usually no difference, dishonesty. Beg for mercy. What does he call himself? I'm a sinner. You ever go to God and to say, I don't mean that all men sin. No, I'm talking about me. You ever go to God and say, God, it's a sinner. It's all I am. I'm sorry. That's what this man did. I'm a sinner. I bring myself mercifully before you. The point is, who was justified? Well, obviously, it was the publican. It was the sinner that nobody cared about. It was the outcast, not the Pharisee. So the very next verse, Jesus says, I tell you which man went to his house justified. He's the one who showed the humility. You exalt yourself, you can be humbled. You humble yourself, you can be exalted. We had this same verse in Mark, or John it was last week, I guess. So we're going to talk about that some more. We got some time toward the end here. Let's move on a minute. Jesus now crosses the Jordan. Again, I thought maybe this territory up here. Crosses the Jordan, and he heads down. He'll come across the Jordan here at Jericho, and we've looked at the video of the road from Jericho up to Jerusalem. That's where he's headed. This is his last time to leave Galilee before he dies. So he's starting that last trip into Jerusalem. Go down to Judea and go to Jerusalem, and this will begin the last week then when he gets there. We jump now to Mark chapter 10. Picked up some events there. It's just kind of fitting in this time frame. Multitudes come to him. He does like he usually does, teaches them. And the Pharisees come, not unusually, like they always do, seems like. They come testing him. They're asking a question. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Matthew 19, as this parallel, adds in, for just any reason. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Mark doesn't have that in there. So Jesus asks them, what Moses commanded. And they say, oh, Moses, he permitted a certificate of divorce. Go back to Deuteronomy 24 for that. I read a lot about that this week. But the ideas of why Moses did this, we're going to see in a minute from the beginning, that was not the way that God intended it to be. So why did Moses allow this? And there's a lot of speculation as to why he might have allowed this. Men were divorcing their wives for just any reason, put them out as a divorcee. If one had been divorced, who had no rights and nobody to take care of her, there's a lot of speculation as to why Moses might have permitted this divorce, certificate of divorce. But they said Moses permitted it. So he first asked, what did Moses command? It is that Moses permitted, they said, was their answer. Jesus said he did it because of the hardness of your heart. Because of the hardness of your heart. You would not you would not want to do what God intended for you to start with. And Moses allowed this, permitted it, because of the hardness of your heart. So Jesus then starts talking about what they really should be doing. He goes back to God's original law of marriage, back to Genesis chapter 2, where he says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two shall become one, a man and his wife. One man, one woman for life. Now here's a question. How do we know that's not just for Adam and Eve, since it was given back there in Genesis chapter 2, where Adam and Eve was the only people there? How do we know that's not just talking about them? Little lesson here, I think. Why is it not just talking about Adam and Eve? What does the verse say? A man should do what? Leave his father and mother. How many people's on the earth right now at that point? Adam and Eve. Adam going to leave his father and mother? I don't think so. It's not talking to Adam and Eve. It's a principle that God's teaching. All the way back in Genesis chapter 2. That's what Jesus goes back to. From the beginning, it was not so. Here's how it was from the beginning. A man is to leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Mark 10, verse 6. From the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Genesis 2:24. The two shall become one flesh, no longer two but one. And what God has joined together, let not man separate. My clicker is having trouble tonight. So here we go. How do you make them from the beginning? Male and female. Who's going to be joined together? A man and his wife. I got to talk to this crowd about this, but you know where it's going. A man and his partner. A woman and her, no, what it says. He made a male and a female, and a man to be joined to his wife. And they two should become one. So then he adds to it. That's how it was supposed to be. Man and wife get married. Leave father and mother, get married. They're together for life. Now, that's how it's supposed to be. So he goes on then and says, whoever divorces his wife, Moses permitted it. Now I'm telling you how it's supposed to be. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Any questions about that? A woman divorces her husband, marries another, she commits adultery. We read this from Luke, last class or class before, same thing in Luke. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Whoever marries who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. Matthew chapter 19 adds an exception clause in. We've talked about the exception clause. Whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, marries who's divorced, same exact thing with the exception clause. Now, there's been lots of questions about this. There's been lots of books written about this. There's been lots of what ifs about this. Here's all I'm going to tell you. Read your text. What does it say? I got anything to say about this before I move on? Sure. Jeff will answer for you. I did not. I think they're just looking for more clarification. I don't remember. I don't remember anything specific about that, Mike. I'm sorry, I don't. Mike's question, verse 2, the Pharisees were testing him with the question, and in verse 10 that goes into the house, and the disciples ask him to explain it to them. So what's their misunderstanding about it, I guess, is the question. So. All right, moving on to Mark chapter 10. They bring little children up around Jesus, and the disciples try to keep them back. It's like, we don't want them bothering, if you will, or getting in the way of our master while he's trying to teach and while he's trying to work. Jesus was not happy about that at all. He said, let them come near, for such is the kingdom of heaven. I did do a lot of reading about that one, Mike. What about little children makes them to where he would say, such is the kingdom of heaven. It's their attitude, their ability to get along, their innocence. I saw all kind of long answers and various speculations and things. For such is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said, let them come. Unless you're converted, become as little children, you by no means wise enter the kingdom of heaven. So Adam Clark, one of the commentators, says about this. He said, be truly without worldly ambition, little children. No lust of power. That's all little children are. And act as if all are equal. Little children. Little children. All right, I've got a few minutes left. Let me run through a couple of things. Got some comments about this. I'll make you glad to have them. Back to the 10 levers a minute. We talk about the faith, the obedience. Your faith has made you whole. Think about gratitude for a minute. You had this awful, dreaded disease, leprosy. No known cure for it. Jesus comes by. You know who he is. He's been on this earth for three and a half years now. Reputation's gotten out. So you know who he's coming. You shout out to him. And he tells you to go show yourself to the priest. And you know immediately. Now the Samaritan, I don't think you or not, but the others, apparently being Jews, they would have known. When do you go show yourself to the priest? You're over your leprosy, right? So what do they know? He's going to heal us. And as they went, they're healed. They're cleansed of this dreaded disease. And this one goes back to say thank you. Why not the nine? That's what Jesus wanted to know. Jesus said, where are the nine? What'd they do? Why couldn't they come back and say thank you? Say, because he said, go show yourself to the priest. I know that. We can still do that. Where's our gratitude? Do we sometimes we pray and pray and pray and pray for something and God grants it? We take time to go back and say, thank you. Or do we start asking what's next? next? We keep asking. Do we ever say thank you? Do we expect God to do what we ask Him to do? We're assured if we ask according to His will, He'll do it. Do we ever go back and say thank you? Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. We taught a couple of classes already about humility, being exalted, sitting at the head table and getting moved down, or going to the lower seat and being moved up. Comes back up again tonight, our lesson again. Larry Wisdom and I have taught this together before, and Larry left some slides I have. So I'm going to show you those slides now. It's just some scriptures, quotations. Let's just read through them and think about them a minute. Think about humility. Here's the question. What's the one thing you need, I need, in order to receive honor and guidance and grace and salvation and exaltation from God? His answer is humility. Let's think about it. You will save the humble people. Psalms 18. The Lord takes pleasure in His people. He will beautify the humble with salvation. The humble He guides in justice, and the humble He teaches His ways. You ever tried to teach somebody that had no humility? Surely He scorns the scornful, but gives grace to the humble. He gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. The fear of the Lord is instruction of wisdom. And before honor is humility. There are different occasions. We've looked at two of them already in this class series. He who humbles himself will be exalted. We've seen that twice already. Worship is to feel in the heart and express in an appropriate way our adoration and awe toward our high and holy God. Worship is humbling. When you put yourself in a position of worship and you worship in a high and holy God, how can you help from being humble? The prideful man cannot worship God any more than the arrogant devil can worship God. Pride doesn't go with humble. Must be humility in the heart before I can worship. And the last one. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God that He may exalt you in due time. There's a time coming for exaltation. We all look forward to it. All right, we got about 1 minute. Anybody got any thoughts before we wrap up? All right. Thank you very much. See you Sunday morning.